Lujan, and some in Emmons Field claimed Elspeth Lujan was almost as strong as her husband. It was not true, but it was not far wrong.
"How can I help you?"
the woman said in an accent like the Ammerlands. Her gray hair was arranged in thick curls that hung down the sides of her head, and her three aprons were in shades of green, each slightly darker than the one below, but even the topmost pale.
"Which one of you needs me?"
"I do," Nynaeve said. "I need something for a queasy stomach, and perhaps one of my companions does too. That is, if we've come to the right place."
"You're not Tyran," the woman said. "I should have known that by your clothes before you spoke. I'm called Mother Gwenna. I'm called a wise woman, too, but I'm old enough not to trust that to caulk a seam. You come, and I will give you something for your stomach."
It was a neat kitchen, though not large, with copper pots hanging on the wall and dried herbs and sausages from the ceiling. Several tall cupboards of pale wood had doors carved with some sort of tall grass. The table had been scrubbed almost white, and the backs of the chairs were carved with flowers. A pot of fishy-smelling soup was simmering atop the stone stove, and a kettle with a spout, just beginning to steam. There was no fire on the stone hearth, for which Egwene was more than grateful. The stove added enough to the heat, though Mother Gwenna seemed not to notice it at all. Dishes lined the mantel, and more were stacked neatly on shelves to either side. The floor looked as if it had just been swept. Mother Gwenna closed the door after them, and as she was crossing the kitchen to her cupboards, Nynaeve said,
"Which tea will you give me? Chain leaf or bluewort?" "I would if I had any of either."
Mother Gwenna rooted in the shelves a moment and came out with a stone jar.
"Since I've had no time to glean of late, I will give you a brew of marsh white leaves."
"I am not familiar with that," Nynaeve said slowly.
"It works as well as chain leaf, but it has a bite to the taste some don't care for."
The big woman sprinkled dried and broken leaves into a blue teapot and carried it over to the fireplace to add hot water.
"Do you follow the craft, then? Sit."
She gestured to the table with a hand holding two blue glazed cups she had taken from the mantel.
"Sit, and we'll talk. Which one of you has the other stomach?"
"I am fine," Egwene said casually as she took a chair. "Are you queasy, Carola?" The daughter heir shook her head with perhaps a touch of exasperation.
"No matter."
The gray-haired woman poured out a cup of dark liquid for Nynaeve, then sat across the table from her.
"I made enough for two, but marsh white tea keeps longer than salted fish. It works better the longer it sits, too, but it also grows more bitter. Makes a race between how much you need your stomach settled and what your tongue can stand. Drink, girl."
After a moment, she filled the second cup and took a sip.
"You see, it will not hurt you."
Nynaeve raised her own cup, making a small sound of displeasure at the first taste. When she lowered the cup again, though, her face was smooth.
"It is just a little bitter, perhaps.
Tell me, Mother Gwenna, will we have to put up with this rain and mud much longer?" The older woman frowned, parceling displeasure among the three of them before she settled on Nynaeve.
"I am not a sea folk windfinder girl," she said quietly. "If I could tell the weather, I'd sooner stick live silver pike down my dress than admit it. The defenders take that sort of thing for next to Aes Sedai work. Now, do you follow the craft or not? You look as if you have been traveling. What is good for fatigue?" she barked suddenly.
"Flatwort tea," Nynaeve said calmly, "or Andalay root. Since you ask questions, what would you do to ease birthing?" Mother Gwenna snorted.
"Apply warm towels, child, and perhaps give her a little white fennel if it was an especially hard birth. A woman needs no more than that and a soothing hand. Can't you think of a question any country farm wife could not answer? What do you give for pains in the heart? The killing kind."
"Powdered giandin blossom on the tongue," Nynaeve said crisply. "If a woman has biting pains in her belly and spits up blood, what do you do?" They settled down as if testing each other, tossing questions and answers back and forth faster and faster.
Sometimes the questioning lagged a moment when one spoke of a plant the other knew only by another name, but they picked up speed again, arguing the merits of tinctures against teas, salves against poultices, and when one was better than another. Slowly all the quick questions began shifting toward the herbs and roots one knew that the other did not, digging for knowledge. Egwene began to grow irritable listening. "After you give him the bone knit," Mother Gwenna was saying, "you wrap the broken limb in toweling soaked in water where you've boiled blue goat flowers. Only the blue, mind." Nynaeve nodded impatiently. "And as hot as he can stand it. One part blue goat flowers to 10 of water, no weaker. Replace the towels as soon as they stop steaming and keep it up all day. The bone will knit twice as fast as with bone knit alone, and twice as strong."
"I will remember that," Nynaeve said. "You mentioned using sheep's tongue root for eye pain. I've never heard—"
Egwene could stand it no longer.
"Mariam," she broke in, "do you really believe you'll ever need to know these things again? You are not a wisdom any longer, or have you forgotten?"
"I have not forgotten anything," Nynaeve said sharply. "I remember a time when you were as eager to learn new things as I am."
"Mother Gwenna," Elaine said blandly, "what do you do for two women who cannot stop arguing?"
The gray-haired woman pursed her lips and frowned at the table. "Usually, men or women, I tell them to stay away from each other. That is the best thing and the easiest."
"Usually," Elaine said. "What if there is a reason they cannot stay apart? Say they are sisters."
"I do have a way to make an arguer stop," the big woman said slowly. "It is not something I urge anyone to try, but some do come to me." Egwene thought there was a suspicion of a smile at the corners of her mouth. "I charge a silver mark each for women. 2 for men, because men make more fuss. There are some will buy anything if it costs enough."
"But what is the cure?" Elaine asked.
"I tell them they have to bring the other one here with them, the one they argue with. Both expect me to quiet the other's tongue."
Despite herself, Egwene was listening.
She noticed Nynaeve seemed to be paying sharp attention as well. "When they have paid me," Mother Gwenna continued, flexing one hefty arm, "I take them out back and stick their heads in my rain barrel till they agree to stop their arguing."
Elaine burst out laughing. "I think I may have done something very like that myself," Nynaeve said, in a voice that was much too light.
Egwene hoped her own expression looked nothing like Nynaeve's. "I'd not be surprised if you have." Mother Gwenna was grinning openly now. "I tell them the next time I hear they've been arguing, I will do it for free, but I'll use the river. It is remarkable how often the cure works, for men especially. And it is remarkable what it has done for my reputation. For some reason, none of the people I cure this way ever tells anyone else the details, so someone asks for the cure every few months. If you've been fool enough to eat mudfish, you do not go around telling people. I trust none of you have any wish to spend a silver mark."
"I think not," Egwene said, and glared at Elaine when she went off in peals of laughter again.
"Good," the gray-haired woman said. "Those I cure of arguing have a tendency to avoid me like stingweed caught in their nets, unless they actually take sick, and I am enjoying your company. Most of those who come at present want something to take away bad dreams, and they grow sour when I have nothing to give them."
For a moment she slipped into a frown, rubbing her temples.
"It is good to see 3 faces that do not look as if there is nothing left but to jump over the side and drown. If you are staying long in Tyr, you must come see me again. The girl called you Mariam? I am Eilwyn. The next time we'll talk over some good sea folk tea instead of something that curdles your tongue. Light, but I hate the taste of marsh white. Mudfish would taste sweeter. In fact, if you have time to stay now, I'll brew a pot of Trimalking Black. Not long till supper, either. It's just bread and soup and cheese, but you are welcome."
"That would be very nice, Eilwyn," Nynaeve said. "Actually, Eilwyn, if you have a spare bedroom, I'd like to hire it for the 3 of us."
The big woman looked at each of them without saying anything. Getting to her feet, she tucked the pot of marsh-white tea away in the herb cupboard, then fetched a red teapot and a pouch from another. Only when she had brewed a pot of Trimalkin Black, put four clean cups and a bowl of honeycomb on the table along with pewter spoons, and reclaimed her chair, did she speak.
"I've three empty bedrooms upstairs, now my daughters are all married. My husband, the light shine on him, was lost in a storm in the Fingers of the Dragon near 20 years ago. There need be no talk of hiring if I decide to let you have the rooms. If, Mariam."
Stirring honey into her tea, she studied them again.
"What will make you decide?" Nynaeve asked quietly.
Eilwyn continued to stir as if she had forgotten to drink.
"Three young women, riding fine horses. I don't know much about horses, but those look as fine as what the lords and ladies ride to me. You, Mariam, know enough of the craft that you ought to have hung herbs in your window already, or should be choosing where to do it. I've never heard of a woman practicing the craft too far from where she was born, but by your tongue you are a long way."
She glanced at Elaine.
"Not many places with hair that color, and, or I'd say, by your speech. Fool men are always talking about finding a yellow-haired Andor girl. What I want to know is why. Running away from something, or running after something? Only you don't look like thieves to me, and I never heard of three women chasing after a man together. So tell me why, and if I like it, the rooms are yours. If you want to pay something, you buy a bit of meat now and then. Meat is dear since the trade up to Cairhien fell away. But first the why, Mariam."
"We are chasing after something, Eilwyn," Nynaeve said. "Or rather, after some people."
Egwene schooled herself to stillness and hoped she was doing as well as Elaine, who was sipping her tea as if she were listening to talk about dresses. Egwene did not believe Eilwyn Gwenna's dark eyes missed a great deal.
"They stole some things, Eilwyn," Nynaeve went on, "from my mother, and they did murder. We are here to see justice done."
"Burn my soul," the large woman said. "Have you no menfolk? Men are not good for much beyond heavy hauling and getting in the way most of the time, and kissing and such. But if there's a battle to be fought or a thief to catch, I say let them do it. Andor is as civilized as Tyr. You are not Aiel."
"There was no one else but us," Nynaeve said. "Those who might have come in our place were killed."
"The three murdered Aes Sedai," Egwene thought. "They could not have been Black Aja, but if they had not been killed, the Amyrlin would not have been able to trust them. She's trying to keep to the bloody three oaths, but she is skirting it close."
"Ah," Eilwyn said sadly. "They killed your men? Brothers or husbands or fathers?"
Spots of color bloomed in Nynaeve's cheeks, and the older woman mistook the emotion.
"Nah, don't tell me, girl. I'll not pull up old grief. Let it lie on the bottom till it melts away. There, there, you calm yourself."
It was an effort for Egwene not to growl with disgust.
"I must tell you this," Nynaeve said in a stiff voice. The red still colored her face. "These murderers and thieves are dark friends. They are women, but they are as dangerous as any swordsman, Eilwyn. If you wondered why we did not seek an inn, that is why. They may know we follow, and they may be watching for us."
Eilwyn waved it all away with a sniff.
"Of the four most dangerous folk I know, two are women who never carry as much as a knife, and only one of the men is a swordsman. As for dark friends, Mariam, when you are as old as I, you'll learn that false dragons are dangerous, lionfish are dangerous, sharks are dangerous, and sudden storms out of the south. But dark friends are fools, filthy fools, but fools. The Dark One is locked up where the Creator put him, and no fetches or fangfish to scare children will get him out. Fools don't frighten me unless they're working the boat I'm riding. I suppose you don't have any proof you could take to the Defenders of the Stone. It would be just your word against theirs."
"What is a fetch?" Egwene wondered. "Or a fangfish, for that matter?"
We will have proof when we find them, Nynaeve said. They will have the things they stole, and we can describe them. They are old things, and of little value to anyone but us and our friends.
You'd be surprised what old things can be worth, Eilwyn said dryly. Old Louise Moulin pulled up 3 heartstone bowls and a cup in his nets last year, down in the fingers of the dragon. Now, instead of a fishing smack, he owns a ship trading up the river. Old fool did not even know what he had till I told him. Very likely there's more right where those came from, but Louise couldn't even remember the exact spot. I do not know how he ever managed to get a fish into his net. Half the fishing boats in Tyr were down there for months afterwards, dragging for quaendiar, not grunts or flatfish, and some had lords saying where to pull the nets. That's what old things can be worth, if they are old enough. Now, I've decided you do need a man in this, and I know just the one.
Who? Nynaeve said quickly. If you mean a lord, one of the High Lords, remember we have no proof to offer till we find them.
Eilwyn laughed until she wheezed. Girl, nobody from the Mawla knows a High Lord or any kind of lord. Mudfish don't school with silversides. I will bring you the dangerous man I know who isn't a swordsman, and the more dangerous of the two at that. Juillin Sandar is a thief-catcher, the best of them. I do not know how it is in Andor, but here a thief-catcher will work for you or me as soon as for a lord or a merchant, and charge less at that. Juillin can find these women for you if they can be found, and bring your things back without you having to go near these dark friends.
Nynaeve agreed as if she were still not entirely sure, and Eilwyn tied those platforms to her shoes, clogs she called them, and hurried out. Egwene watched her go, through one of the kitchen windows, past the horses and around the corner up the alley.
"You are learning how to be Aes Sedai, Mariam," she said as she turned from the window. "You manipulate people as well as Moiraine."
Nynaeve's face went white. Elaine stalked across the floor and slapped Egwene's face. Egwene was so shocked she could only stare.
"You go too far,"
the golden-haired woman said sharply.
"Too far. We must live together, or we will surely die together. Did you give Eilwyn your true name? Nynaeve told her what we could, that we seek dark friends, and that was risk enough, linking us with dark friends. She told her they were dangerous. Murderers. Would you have had her say they were Black Aja? In Tyr? Would you risk everything on whether Eilwyn would keep that to herself?
Egwene rubbed her cheek gingerly. Elaine had a strong arm.
I do not like having to do it.
I know, Elaine sighed.
Neither do I, but we do have to.
Egwene turned back to peering through the window at the horses.
I know we do. But I do not have to like it.
Chapter 49. A Storm in Tyr. Egwene finally returned to the table and her tea. She thought perhaps Elaine was right that she had gone too far, but she could not bring herself to apologize, and they sat in silence. When Eilwyn returned, she had a man with her, a lean fellow in his middle years who looked as if he had been carved from aged wood. Juillin Sandar took off his clogs by the door and hung his flat, conical straw hat on a peg. A swordbreaker, much like Hurin's but with short slots to either side of the long one, hung from a belt over his brown coat, and he carried a staff exactly as tall as he was, but not much thicker than his thumb, and made of that pale wood, like ridged joints, that the ox-drivers used for their goads. His short-cut black hair lay flat on his head, and his quick dark eyes seemed to note and record every detail of the room, and of everyone in it. Egwene would have bet he examined Nynaeve twice, and to her at least, Nynaeve's lack of reaction was blatant. It was obvious she knew it too. Eilwyn motioned him to a place at the table where he turned back the cuffs of his coat sleeves, bowed to each of them in turn, and sat with his staff propped against his shoulder, not speaking until the gray-haired woman had made a fresh pot of tea and everyone had sipped from their cups.
"Mother Gwenna has told me of your problem," he said quietly as he set his cup down.
I will help you if I can, but the High Lords may have their own business to put me to soon. The big woman snorted.
Juelin, when did you begin haggling like a shopkeeper trying to charge silk prices for linen? Do not claim you know when the High Lords will summon you before they do.
I won't claim it, Sandar told her with a smile. But I know when I've seen men on the rooftops in the night, just out of the corner of my eye. They can hide like pipefish in reeds, but I have seen the movement. No one has reported a theft yet, but there are thieves working inside the walls, and you can buy your supper with that. Mark me. Before another week, I'll be summoned to the stone because a band of thieves is breaking into merchants' houses or even lords' manors. The defenders may guard the streets, but when thieves need tracking, they send for a thief catcher, and me before any other. I'm not trying to drive up my price, but whatever I do for these pretty women, I must do soon.
I believe he speaks the truth, Eilwyn said reluctantly. He'll tell you the moon is green and water white if he thinks it will bring him a kiss, but he lies less than most men about other things. He may be the most honest man ever born in the Mala.
Elaine put a hand over her mouth, and Egwene struggled not to laugh. Nynaeve sat unmoved and obviously impatient. Sandar grimaced at the gray-haired woman, then apparently decided to ignore what she had said. He smiled at Nynaeve.
I will admit that I'm curious about these thieves. I've known women thieves and bands of thieves, but I've never heard of a band of women thieves before, and I owe Mother Gwenna favors.
His eyes seemed to record Nynaeve all over again.
What do you charge? She asked sharply.
To recover stolen goods, he said briskly.
I ask the 10th part of the value of what I recover. For finding someone, I ask a silver mark for each person. Mother Gwenna says the things stolen have little value except to you, mistress, so I suggest you take that choice.
He smiled again. He had very white teeth.
I would not take money from you at all, except that the Brotherhood would frown on it, but I will take as little as I can. A copper or two, no more.
I know a thief-taker, Elaine told him, from Shinar. A very respectful man. He carries a sword as well as a sword-breaker. Why do you not?
Sandar looked startled for a moment, and then upset with himself for being startled. He had not caught her hint, or else had decided to ignore it.
You are not Tyran. I have heard of Shinar, mistress. Tales of Trollocs, and every man a warrior.
His smile said these were tales for children. True stories, Egwene said, or true enough. I've been to Shinar.
He blinked at her and went on. I am not a lord, nor a wealthy merchant, nor even a soldier. The defenders do not trouble foreigners much for carrying swords, unless they mean to stay long, of course. But I would be thrust into a cell under the stone. There are laws, mistress.
His hand rubbed along his staff as if unconsciously.
I do as well as may be, without a sword.
He focused his smile on Nynaeve once more.
Now, if you will describe these things...
He stopped as she set her purse on the edge of the table and counted out 13 silver marks. Egwene thought she had chosen the lightest coins. Most were Tyran, only one Andoran. The Amyrlin had given them a great deal of gold, but even that would not last forever. Nynaeve looked into the purse thoughtfully before tightening the strings and putting it back into her pouch.
There are 13 women for you to find, Master Sandar. With as much silver again when you do. Find them, and we will recover our property ourselves.
I will do that myself for less than this, he protested. And there's no need for extra rewards. I charge what I charge. Have no fear I'll take a bribe.
There is no fear of that, Eilwyn agreed. I said he is honest. Just do not believe him if he says he loves you.
Sandar glared at her.
I pay the coin, Master Sandar, Nynaeve said firmly. So I choose what I am buying. Will you find these women, and no more?
She waited for him to nod reluctantly before going on.
They may be together or not,
The first is a Tara Boner. She is a little taller than I, with dark eyes and pale, honey-colored hair that she wears in many small braids after the Tarabon fashion. Some men might think her pretty, but she would not consider it a compliment. She has a mean, sulky mouth. The second is Kandori. She has long black hair with a white streak above her left ear, and... She gave no names, and Sandar asked for none. Names were so easily changed. His smile was gone now that the business was at hand. 13 women she described as he listened intently, and when she was done, Egwene was sure he could have recited them back word for word. "Mother Gwenna may have told you this," Nynaeve finished, "but I will repeat it. These women are more dangerous than you can believe. Over a dozen have died at their hands already, that I know of, and I would not be surprised if that was only a drop of the blood on their hands." Sandar and Eilwyn both blinked at that. "If they discover you are asking after them, you will die. If they take you, they will make you tell where we are, and Mother Gwenna will probably die with us." The gray-haired woman looked disbelieving. "Believe it," Nynaeve's stare demanded agreement. "Believe it, or I'll take back the silver and find another with more brains." "When I was young," Sandar said, voice serious, "a cutpurse put her knife in my ribs because I thought a pretty young girl wouldn't be as quick to stab as a man. I do not make that mistake anymore. I will behave as if these women are all Aes Sedai and Black Aja." Egwene almost choked, and he gave her a rueful grin as he scooped the coins into his own purse and stuck it behind his sash. "I did not mean to frighten you, mistress. There are no Aes Sedai in Tyr. It may take a few days, unless they are together. 13 women together will be easy to find. Apart, they will be harder. But either way, I will find them, and I will not frighten them away before you learn where they are." When he had donned his straw hat and clogs and departed by the back door, Elaine said, "I hope he is not overconfident. Eilwyn, I heard what he said, but he does understand that they are dangerous, does he not?"
"He has never been a fool except for a pair of eyes or a pretty ankle," the gray-haired woman said, "and that is a failing of every man. He is the best thief-catcher in Tyr. Have no worry. He will find these dark friends of yours."
"It will rain again before morning," Nynaeve shivered, despite the warmth of the room. "I feel a storm gathering."
Eilwyn only shook her head and set about filling bowls with fish soup for supper.
After they ate and cleaned up, Nynaeve and Eilwyn sat at the table talking of herbs and cures. Elaine worked on a small patch of embroidery she had begun on the shoulder of her cloak, tiny blue and white flowers, then read in a copy of The Essays of Willem of Manaches that Eilwyn had on her small shelf of books. Egwene tried reading, but neither the essays nor the travels of Jane Farstrider nor the humorous tales of Alaria Elfin could hold her interest for more than a few pages. She fingered the stone Turangrial through the bosom of her dress. "Where are they? What do they want in the heart? None but the dragon, none but Rand can touch Kalendor, so what do they want? What? What?"
As night deepened, Eilwyn showed them each to a bedroom on the second floor, but after she had gone to her own, they gathered in Egwene's by the light of a single lamp. Egwene had already undressed to her shift, the cord hung round her neck with the two rings. The striped stone felt far heavier than the gold. This was what they had done every night since leaving Tar Valon, with the sole exception of that night with the Aiel.
"Wake me after an hour," she told them. Elaine frowned. "So short this time?"
"Do you feel uneasy?" Nynaeve said. "Perhaps you are using it too often."
"We would still be in Tar Valon scrubbing pots and hoping to find a black sister before a gray man found us if I had not," Egwene said sharply.
"Light. Elaine's right. I am snapping like a sulky child."
She took a deep breath. "Perhaps I am uneasy. Maybe it is because we are so close to the heart of the stone now. So close to Kalendor. So close to the trap, whatever it is."
Be careful, Elaine said, and Nynaeve said, more quietly, Be very careful, Egwene, please. She was tugging her braid in short jerks.
As Egwene lay down on the low-posted bed with them on stools to either side, thunder rolled across the sky. Sleep came slowly. It was the rolling hills again, as always at first, flowers and butterflies under spring sunshine, soft breezes and birds singing. She wore green silk this time, with golden birds embroidered over her breasts, and green velvet slippers. The Turangrial seemed light enough to drift up out of her dress, except for the weight of the great serpent ring holding it down. By simple trial and error she had learned a little of the rules of Telairanriod. Even this world of dreams, this unseen world, had its rules, if odd ones. She was sure she did not know a tenth of them, and one way to make herself go where she wanted. Closing her eyes, she emptied her mind as she would have to embrace Sayidar. It was not as easy because the rosebud kept trying to form and she kept sensing the true source, kept aching to embrace it. But she had to fill the emptiness with something else. She pictured the heart of the stone, as she had seen it in these dreams, formed it in every detail, perfect within the void. The huge, polished redstone columns, the age-worn stones of the floor, the dome far overhead, the crystal sword, untouchable, slowly revolving hilt down in mid-air. When it was so real she was sure she could reach out and touch it, she opened her eyes, and she was there, in the heart of the stone. Or the heart of the stone as it existed in Telairanriod. The columns were there, and Kalendor, and around the sparkling sword, almost as dim and insubstantial as shadows, 13 women sat cross-legged, staring at Kalendor as it revolved. Honey-haired Leandrin turned her head, looking straight at Egwene with those big dark eyes, and her rosebud mouth smiled. Gasping, Egwene sat up in bed so fast she almost fell off the side.
"What is the matter?" Elaine demanded. "What happened? You look frightened."
"You only just closed your eyes," Nynaeve said softly. "This is the first time since the very beginning that you've come back without us waking you. Something did happen, didn't it?" She tugged her braid sharply. "Are you all right?"
"How did I get back?" Egwene wondered. "Light. I do not even know what I did."
She knew she was only trying to put off what she had to say. Unfastening the cord around her neck, she held the great serpent ring and the larger, twisted Turangrial on her palm.
"They are waiting for us," she said finally. There was no need to say who. "And I think they know we are in Tyr."
Outside, the storm broke over the city.
Rain drumming on the deck over his head, Matt stared at the stones board on the table between him and Tom, but he could not really concentrate on the game, even with an Andoran silver mark riding on the outcome. Thunder crashed and lightning flashed in the small windows. Four lamps lit the captain's cabin of the Swift. Bloody ship may be as sleek as the bird, but it's still taking too bloody long. The vessel gave a small jolt, then another. The motion seemed to change. He had better not run us into the bloody mud. If he is not making the best time he can wring out of this butter tub, I will stuff that gold down his throat. Yawning, he had not slept well since leaving Camelin. He could not stop worrying enough to sleep well. Yawning, he set a white stone on the intersection of two lines. In three moves, he would capture nearly a fifth of Tom's black stones.
"You could be a good player, boy," the gleeman said, around his pipe, placing his next stone, "if you put your mind to it."
His tabak smelled like leaves and nuts. Matt reached for another stone from the pile at his elbow, then blinked and let it lie. In the same three moves, Tom's stones would surround over a third of his. He had not seen it coming, and he could see no escape.
"Do you ever lose a game? Have you ever lost a game?"
Tom removed his pipe and knuckled his mustaches.
"Not in a long while. Morghese used to beat me about half the time. It is said good commanders of soldiers and good players of the great game are good at stones as well. She is the one, and I've no doubt she could command a battle, too."
"Wouldn't you rather dice some more? Stones take too much time."
I like a chance to win more than one toss in 9 or 10, the white-haired man said dryly. Matt bounded to his feet as the door banged open to admit Captain Derna. The square-faced man whipped his cloak from his shoulders, shaking the rain off and muttering curses to himself.
The light's in my bones. I do not know why I ever let you hire Swift. You, demanding more flaming speed in the blackest night or the heaviest rain. More speed. Always more bloody speed. Could have run a bloody mud flat 100 times over by now.
You wanted the gold, Matt said harshly. You said this heap of old boards was fast, Derna. When do we reach Tyr? The captain smiled a tight smile.
We are tying off to the dock now. And burn me for a bloody farmer if I carry anything that can flaming talk ever again. Now, where is the rest of my gold?
Matt hurried to one of the small windows and peered out. In the harsh glare of lightning flashes, he could see a wet stone dock, if not much else. He fished the second purse of gold from his pocket and tossed it to Derna. Whoever heard of a riverman who didn't dice?
About time, he growled. Light send I'm not too late.
He had stuffed all of his spare clothes and his blankets into the leather script, and he hung that on one side of him and the roll of fireworks on the other from the cord he tied to it. His cloak covered it all, but gapped a little in the front. Better he got wet than the fireworks. He could dry out and be as good as new. A test with the bucket had shown fireworks could not.
I guess Rand's Da was right.
Matt had always thought the village council would not set them off in the rain because they made a better show on clear nights.
Aren't you about ready to sell those things? Tom was settling his gleeman's cloak on his shoulders.
It covered the leather-cased harp and flute, but his bundle of clothes and blankets he slung on his back outside the patch-covered cloak.
Not until I figure out how they work, Tom. Besides, think what fun it will be when I set them all off.
The gleeman shuddered.
As long as you don't do it all at once, boy. As long as you don't throw them in the fireplace at supper. I'd not put it past you, the way you've been behaving with them. You're lucky the captain here did not throw us off the ship 2 days ago.
He wouldn't, Matt laughed. Not while that purse was in the offing, eh, Derna? Derna was tossing the purse of gold in his hand.
I have not asked before this, but you've given me the gold now, and you'll not take it back. What is this all about, all this flaming speed?
A wager, Derna.
Yawning, Matt picked up his quarterstaff, ready to go.
A wager.
A wager!
Derna stared at the heavy purse. The other, just like it, was locked in his money chest.
There must be a flaming kingdom riding on it.
More than that, Matt said.
Rain bucketed down on the deck so hard that he could not see the gangplank except when lightning crackled above the city. The roar of the downpour barely let him hear himself think. He could see lights in windows up a street, though. There would be inns up there. The captain had not come out on deck to see them ashore, and none of the crew had stayed out in the rain either. Matt and Tom made their way to the stone dock alone. Matt cursed when his boots sank into the mud of the street, but there was nothing for it, so he kept on, striding along as fast as he could with his boots and the butt of his staff sticking at every step. The air smelled of fish, rank even with the rain.
"We'll find an inn," he said loudly, so he could be heard. "And then I will go out looking."
"In this weather?"
Tom shouted back. Rain was rolling down his face, but he was more interested in keeping his instruments covered than his face.
"Komar could have left Camelin before us. If he had a good horse instead of the crowbaits we were riding, he could have set out downriver from Erengil maybe a full day ahead of us. And I don't know how much of that we caught up with that idiot Derna."
"It was a quick passage," Tom allowed. "Swift deserves its name."
"Be that as it may, Tom, rain or no rain, I have to find him before he finds Egwene and Nynaeve and Elaine."
"A few more hours won't make much difference, boy. There are hundreds of inns in a city the size of Tyr. There may be hundreds more outside the walls, some of them little places with no more than a dozen rooms to let, so tiny you could walk right by them and never know they were there."
The gleeman hitched the hood of his cloak up more, muttering to himself.
"It will take weeks to search them all, but it will take Komar the same weeks. We can spend the night in out of the rain. You can wager whatever coin you have left that Komar won't be out in it."
Matt shook his head.
a tiny inn with a dozen rooms. Before he left Emmons Field, the biggest building he had ever seen was the Winespring Inn. He doubted if Bran Alvear had any more than a dozen rooms to let. Egwene had lived with her parents and her sisters in the rooms at the front of the second floor.
Burn me. Sometimes I think we should never any of us have left Emmons Field.
But Rand surely had had to, and Egwene would probably have died if she had not gone to Tarvalen.
Now she might die because she did go.
He did not think he could settle for the farm again. The cows and the sheep certainly would not play dice. But Perrin still had a chance to go home.
Go home, Perrin, he found himself thinking. Go home while you still can.
He gave himself a shake.
Fool! Why would he want to?
He thought of bed, but pushed it away.
Not yet.
Lightning streaked across the sky, three jagged bolts together casting a stark light over a narrow house that seemed to have bunches of herbs hanging in the windows, and a shop, shut up tight, but a potter's from the sign with its bowls and plates. Yawning, he hunched his shoulders against the driving rain and tried to pull his boots out of the clinging mud more quickly.
I think I can forget about this part of the city, Tom, he shouted. All this mud and that stink of fish. Can you see Nynaeve or Egwene or Elaine choosing to stay here? Women like things neat and tidy, Tom, and smelling good.
Maybe, boy, Tom muttered, then coughed.
You would be surprised what women will put up with.
But it may be.
Holding his cloak to keep the roll of fireworks covered, Matt lengthened his stride.
Come on, Tom. I want to find Komar or the girls tonight, one or the other.
Tom limped after him, coughing now and again. They strode through the wide gates in the city, unguarded in the rain, and Matt was relieved to feel paving stones under his feet again. And not more than 50 paces up the street was an inn, the windows of the common room spilling light onto the street, music drifting out into the night. Even Tom covered that last 50 paces through the rain quickly, limp or no limp. The White Crescent had a landlord whose girth made his long blue coat fit snugly below the waist as well as above, unlike those of most of the men in the low-backed chairs at the tables. Matt thought the landlord's baggy breeches, tied at the ankle above low shoes, had to be big enough for two ordinary men to fit inside, one in each leg. The serving women wore dark, high-necked dresses and short white aprons. There was a fellow playing a hammered dulcimer between the two stone fireplaces. Tom eyed the fellow critically and shook his head. The rotund innkeeper, Cavan Lopar by name, was more than glad to give them rooms. He frowned at their muddy boots, but silver from Matt's pocket, the gold was running low, and Tom's patch-covered cloak smoothed his fat forehead. When Tom said he would perform for a small fee some nights, Lopar's chins waggled with pleasure. Of a big man with a white streak in his beard, he knew nothing, nor of three women meeting the descriptions Matt gave. Matt left everything but his cloak and his quarterstaff in his room, barely looking to see that it had a bed. Sleep was enticing, but he refused to let himself think of it. Then wolfed down a spicy fish stew and rushed back out into the rain. He was surprised that Tom came with him.
I thought you wanted to be in where it's dry, Tom.
The gleeman patted the flute case he still had under his cloak. The rest of his things were up in his room.
People talk to a gleeman, boy. I may learn something you would not. I'd not like to see those girls harmed any more than you.
There was another inn 100 paces down the rain-filled street on the other side, and another 200 beyond that, and then more. Matt took them as he came to them, ducking in long enough for Tom to flourish his cloak and tell a story, then let somebody buy him a cup of wine afterwards while Matt asked around after a tall man with a white streak in his close-cut black beard and three women. He won a few coins at dice, but he learned nothing, and neither did Tom. He was just glad the gleeman seemed to be taking only a few sips of wine at each inn. Tom had been close to abstemious on the boat, but Matt had not been certain he would not dive back into the wine once they reached Tyr. By the time they had visited 24 common rooms, Matt felt as if his eyelids had weights. The rain had lessened a bit, but it still fell steadily in big drops, and as the rain fell off, the wind had freshened. The sky had the dark gray look of coming dawn.
Boy, Tom muttered, if we don't go back to the White Crescent, I'm going to go to sleep here in the rain.
He stopped to cough.
Do you realize you've marched right past three inns? Light, I am so tired I can't think. Do you have a scheme of where to go that you have not told me?
Matt stared blearily up the street at a tall man in a cloak hurrying around a corner.
Light, I am tired. Rand is 500 leagues from here, playing at being the bloody dragon.
What? Three inns?
They were standing almost in front of another, the Golden Cup, according to the sign, creaking in the wind. It looked nothing like a dice cup, but he decided to give it a try anyway.
One more, Tom. If we don't find them here, we'll go back and go to bed.
Bed sounded better than a dice game with 100 gold marks riding on the toss, but he made himself go in. 2 steps into the common room, Matt saw him. The big man wore a green coat with blue stripes down puffy sleeves, but it was Komar, close-cut black beard with a white streak over his chin and all. He sat in one of the strangely low-backed chairs at a table on the far side of the room, rattling a leather dice cup and smiling at the man across from him. That fellow wore a long coat and baggy breeches, and he was not smiling. He stared at the coins on the table as if wishing he had them back in his purse. Another dice cup sat at Komar's elbow. Komar upended the leather cup in his hand and began laughing almost before the dice stopped spinning.
"Who is next?"
he called loudly, pulling the wager to his side of the table. There was already a considerable pile of silver in front of him. He scooped the dice into the cup and rattled them.
"Surely someone else wants to try his luck?"
It seemed that no one did, but he kept rattling the cup and laughing. The innkeeper was easy to pick out, though they did not seem to wear aprons in Tyr. His coat was the same shade of deep blue as that of every other innkeeper Matt had spoken to. A plump man, though little more than half the size of Lopar, and with half that fellow's number of chins, he was sitting at a table by himself, polishing a pewter mug furiously and glaring across the room toward Komar, though not when Komar was looking. Some of the other men gave the bearded man sidelong frowns, too, but not when he was looking. Matt suppressed his first urge, which was to rush over to Komar, drub him over the head with his quarterstaff, and demand to know where Egwene and the others were. Something was wrong here. Komar was the first man he had seen wearing a sword, but the way the men looked at him was more than fear of a swordsman. Even the serving woman, who had brought Komar a fresh cup of wine and was pinched for her trouble, had a nervous laugh for him.
"Look at it from every side," Matt thought wearily. "Half the trouble I get into is from not doing that. I have to think."
Tiredness seemed to have stuffed his head with wool. He motioned to Tom, and they strolled over to the innkeeper, who eyed them suspiciously when they sat down.
"Who is the man with the stripe in his beard?" Matt asked.
"Not from the city, are you?" the innkeeper said. "He is a foreigner, too. I've never seen him before tonight, but I know what he is. Some outlander who has come here and made his fortune in trade. A merchant rich enough to wear a sword. That is no reason for him to treat us like this."
"If you have never seen him before," Matt said, "how do you know he is a merchant?" The innkeeper looked at him as if he were stupid.
"His coat, man, and his sword. He cannot be a lord or a soldier if he's from off, so he has to be a rich merchant."
He shook his head for the stupidity of foreigners.
"They come to our places to look down their noses at us and fondle the girls under our very eyes. But he has no call to do this. If I go to the mall, I don't gamble for some fisherman's coins. If I go to Tavar, I do not dice with the farmers come to sell their crops."
His polishing gained in ferocity.
"Such luck the man has. It must be how he made his fortune."
"He wins, does he?"
Yawning, Matt wondered how he would do, dicing with another man who had luck.
"Sometimes he loses," the innkeeper muttered, "when the stake is a few silver pennies. Sometimes. But let it reach a silver mark. No less than a dozen times tonight I've seen him win at crowns with 3 crowns and 2 roses. And half again as often at top. It has to be 3 sixes and 2 fives. He tosses nothing but 6s at 3s, and 3 sixes and a 5 every throw at compass. If he has such luck, I say the light shine on him, and well to him. But let him use it with other merchants, as is proper. How can a man have such luck?"
"Weighted dice," Tom said, then coughed. "When he wants to be sure of winning, he uses dice that always show the same face. He is smart enough not to have made it the highest toss. Folk become suspicious if you always throw the king."
He raised an eyebrow at Matt.
"Just one that's all but impossible to beat. but he cannot change that they always show the same face.
I have heard of such, the innkeeper said slowly. Ilianas use them, I hear.
Then he shook his head.
But both men use the same cup and dice. It cannot be.
Bring me two dice cups, Tom said, and two sets of dice. Crowns or spots, it makes no difference so long as they are the same.
The innkeeper frowned at him but left, prudently taking the pewter cup with him, and came back with two leather cups. Tom rolled the five bones cubes from one onto the table in front of Matt.
Whether with spots or symbols, every set of dice Matt had ever seen had either been bone or wood. These had spots. He picked them up, frowning at Tom.
Am I supposed to see something?
Tom dumped the dice from the other cup into his hand then, almost too quickly to follow, dropped them back in and twisted the cup over to rest upside down on the table before the dice could fall out. He kept his hand on top of the cup.
Put a mark on each of them, boy. Something small, but something you'll know for your mark.
Matt found himself exchanging puzzled glances with the innkeeper. Then they both looked at the cup upside down under Tom's hand. He knew Tom was up to something tricky. Gleemen were always doing things that were impossible, like eating fire and pulling silk out of the air. But he did not see how Tom could do anything with him watching close. He unsheathed his belt knife and made a small scratch on each die, right across the circle of six spots.
All right, he said, setting them back on the table. Show me your trick.
Tom reached over and picked up the dice, then set them down again a foot away.
Look for your marks, boy.
Matt frowned. Tom's hand was still on the upended leather cup. The gleeman had not moved it or taken Matt's dice anywhere near it. He picked up the dice and blinked. There was not a scratch on them. The innkeeper gasped. Tom turned his free hand over, revealing five dice.
Your marks are on these. That is what Komar is doing. It is a child's trick, simple, though I'd never have thought he had the fingers for it.
I do not think I want to play dice with you after all, Matt said slowly.
The innkeeper was staring at the dice, but not as if he saw any solution.
Call the watch, or whatever you call it here, Matt told him. Have him arrested.
He'll kill nobody in a prison cell.
Yet what if they are already dead?
He tried not to listen, but the thought persisted.
Then I'll see him dead, and Gabriel. Whatever it takes. But they aren't, burn me. They can't be.
The innkeeper was shaking his head.
Me? Denounce a merchant to the defenders? They would not even look at his dice. He could say one word and I would be in chains working the channel dredges in the fingers of the dragon. He could cut me down where I stood, and the defenders would say I had earned it. Perhaps he will go away after a while.
Matt gave him a wry grimace.
If I expose him, will that be good enough?
Will you call the watch or the defenders or whoever then? You do not understand. You are a foreigner. Even if he is from off, he is a wealthy man, important.
Wait here, Matt told Tom. I do not mean to let him reach Egwene and the others, whatever it takes.
He yawned as he scraped back his chair.
Wait, boy,
Tom called after him, soft yet urgent. The gleeman pushed himself up out of his chair.
Burn you, you don't know what you're putting your foot into.
Matt waved for him to stay there and walked over to Komar. No one else had taken up the bearded man's challenge, and he eyed Matt with interest as Matt leaned his quarterstaff against the table and sat down. Komar studied Matt's coat and grinned nastily.
You want to wager coppers, farmer? I do not waste my time with...
He cut off as Matt set an Andoran gold crown on the table and yawned at him, making no effort to cover his mouth.
You say little, farmer, though your manners could use improving. But gold has a voice of its own and no need of manners.
He shook the leather cup in his hand and spilled the dice out. He was chuckling before they came to rest, showing three crowns and two roses.
You'll not beat that, farmer. Perhaps you have more gold hidden in those rags that you want to lose. What did you do, rob your master?
He reached for the dice, but Matt scooped them up ahead of him. Komar glared, but let him have the cup. If both tosses were the same, they would throw again until one man won.
Matt smiled as he rattled the dice. He did not mean to give Komar a chance to change them. If they threw the same toss 3 or 4 times in a row, exactly the same every time, even these defenders would listen. The whole common room would see. They would have to back his word. He spilled the dice onto the tabletop. They bounced oddly. He felt something shifting. It was as if his luck had gone wild. The room seemed to be writhing around him, tugging at the dice with threads. For some reason, he wanted to look at the door, but he kept his eyes on the dice. They came to rest. 5 crowns. Komar's eyes looked ready to pop out of his head.
You lose, Matt said softly.
If his luck was in to this extent, perhaps it was time to push it. A voice in the back of his head told him to think, but he was too tired to listen. I think your luck is used up, Komar. If you've harmed those girls, it's all gone.
I have not even found...
Komar began, still staring at the dice, then jerked his head up. His face had gone white.
How do you know my name?
He had not found them yet.
Luck, sweet luck, stay with me.
Go back to Camelin, Komar. Tell Gabriel you could not find them. Tell him they are dead. Tell him anything but leave Tyr tonight. If I see you again, I'll kill you.
Who are you? The big man said unsteadily. Who?
The next instant, his sword was out, and he was on his feet. Matt shoved the table at him, overturning it, and grabbed for his quarterstaff. He had forgotten how big Komar was. The bearded man pushed the table right back at him. Matt fell over with his chair, holding a bare grasp on his staff, as Komar heaved the table out of the way and stabbed at him. Matt threw his feet against the man's middle to stop his rush, swung the staff awkwardly, just enough to deflect the sword. But the blow knocked the staff from his fingers, and he found himself gripping Komar's wrist instead, with the man's blade a hand from his face. With a grunt, he rolled backwards, heaving as hard as he could with his legs. Komar's eyes widened as he sailed over Matt to crash onto a table, face up. Matt scrambled for his staff, but when he had it, Komar had not moved. The big man lay with his hips and legs sprawled across the top of the table, the rest of him hanging down with his head on the floor. The men who had been sitting at the table were on their feet, a safe distance away, wringing their hands and eyeing each other nervously. A low, worried buzz filled the common room, not the noise Matt expected. Komar's sword lay within easy reach of his hand, but he did not move. He stared at Matt, though, as Matt kicked the sword away and went to one knee beside him.
Light, I think his back is broken. I told you you should have gone, Komar. Your luck is all used up. Fool, the big man breathed. Do you think I was the only one hunting them? They won't live till...
His eyes stared at Matt, and his mouth was open, but he said no more. Nor ever would again. Matt met the glazing stare, trying to will more words out of the dead man.
Who else, burn you? Who? What are they? My luck. Burn me. What happened to my luck?
He became aware of the innkeeper pulling frantically at his arm.
You must go. You must. Before the defenders come. I will show them the dice. I will tell them it was an outlander, but a tall man, with red-colored hair and gray eyes. No one will suffer. A man I dreamed of last night. No one real. No one will contradict me. He took coin from everyone with his dice. But you must go. You must.
Everyone else in the room was studiously looking another way. Matt let himself be hauled away from the dead man and pushed outside. Tom was already waiting in the rain. He seized Matt's arm and limped down the street hurriedly, pulling Matt stumbling behind him. Matt's hood hung down his back, and the rain soaked his hair and poured down his face, down his neck. But he did not notice. The gleeman kept looking over his shoulder, searching the street beyond Matt.
Are you asleep, boy? You do not look asleep back there. Come on, boy! The defenders will arrest any outlander within 2 streets, no matter what description that innkeeper gives.
It's the luck, Matt mumbled. I figured it out. The dice. My luck works best when things are random. Like dice. Not much good at cards, no good at stones, too much pattern. It has to be random. Even finding Komar. I'd stopped visiting every inn. I'd walked into that one by chance.
Tom, if I'm going to find Egwene and the others in time, I have to look without any pattern.
What are you talking about? The man is dead. If you already killed them, well,